Well, it's marathon week here in Boston, and what an awesome time. If you have not watched the Boston Marathon, I don't know, do you live under a rock? It's pretty much a thing. Anyway, it's quite an extraordinary feat. I've never tried to run a marathon, haven't really. When I was younger, I did run a bit, but, you know, I'm not really a runner. And it's really an extraordinary thing to be able to run for distance. There's something I hear from runners that kind of takes over at a certain point in the run. And I sort of think about that a lot when you're going the distance with a kid like my Elizabeth. You know, you get into the groove after a while. I used to counsel parents, moms, mostly at the beginning of their journey, when everything was a crisis. And, you know, I would let them know that things were going to settle down. It didn't feel that way when your kids were young or when you would first get a diagnosis. You know, and people would tell me who are runners that in the beginning of the run, when you're kind of in the thick of it and you're gasping for breath, and they call it, I think, something like trying to get your stride. And I might not have the terminology correct. But that's the way it is too when you're parenting a medically fragile kid. You're trying to get your stride. And it can take a while. And every family gets into their stride at a different time. It takes a different amount of time for people to hit that stride. And there are a few families that never get there. They live in crisis constantly. And not because the kiddo is in crisis constantly. It's because the family never learns to live with the crisis and to adapt. It's a hard way to live. No kidding. When you live with that high level of stress and adrenaline, it takes its toll on your body. There's a lot of research and a lot of articles that you can read. And I actually once knew a doctor that was doing this research at Boston Children's Hospital about the levels of cortisol and different things that impacted caregivers of long-term patients, medically fragile patients, and how that impacts people who are caregivers, whether it's the types of injuries that you have, the level of the extra weight that we carry, just the lack of sleep that we get. Even if our kids are not up all night, we have a lot of sleep interruption because we worry we can't calm our brains down. Lots and lots of impact that being in that constant fight or flight mode in our brains and in our lives just can have on us. So living this way, living in constant stress and fear and crisis, can be very detrimental, very devastating physically to us. And then, of course, living a conflict-ridden life, crisis-ridden life, can be very detrimental to our families, to all of the people around us. And it can erode relationships. It can erode our financial well-being. And it just has this ripple effect in a pond, like in a pond. So having said all of that, you know, getting back to catching your stride, this is not hopeless. There are things you can do. There are things that you can learn to adapt to this situation. And that's why so much work has been done and still needs to be done with caregivers. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the marathon today and about you know, all the things that can be done with caregivers. And, you know, it's the middle of April. And as we roll into May, we're going to be talking about Mother's Day. We're going to be talking about my Elizabeth's birthday, which is at the end of May, and some really heartfelt topics for me, some things that are really important. I really just want to kind of lay some groundwork for having you all think about making some choices about how you want to live your life. Think about the things that are important to you. Now, this week is also National Volunteer Week, recognizing our volunteers around the country and many people who become engaged with or involved with the disability community who aren't connected in a personal way start out as a volunteer. And that's no different than my guest this week. And it is really exciting for me to introduce you to Josh Fields, who is the CEO and co-founder of the Next Step Programs, one of the very important programs out there that works on bringing jobs to young people with disabilities. You know, inclusion is not what it started out to be when we first started talking about it in the 80s. It's evolved a lot. You can't just pick up somebody with an intellectual disability and pop them into an environment that has people without intellectual disabilities and say, oh, we've included you. That doesn't have any meaning. In order for inclusion to be meaningful, there has to be true community access. There has to be true access to the activity. There has to be real change and evolution. And I think you know from, you know, what we've been talking about here for 4 years in the podcast that, you know, I'm getting at, we're talking about real representation in our community here. So the Next Step Programs is an attempt, and they're really doing it, at bringing young people with disabilities into our communities in a truly meaningful way. So, you know, as always, I hope that you enjoy this conversation. I'm really excited to introduce you to Josh Fields. And he started out as just getting introduced to the disability community, and he took it to a new and exciting and interesting place. So let's see what you think. Here we go. And I'm here today with Josh Fields, who is going to talk to us about a very important topic, employment for people with disabilities, something that I bring up on this podcast every couple of months, something near and dear to my heart, an issue that has come up in the news recently. I think, you know, good news, definitely a lot of articles just popped up over the last couple of days saying that we're up over 2% for employment for people with disabilities. But I think that maybe we're still not counting properly all the people that would like to be employed. I don't think that, you know, the numbers are really where they should be. However, I'm going to jump in and talk to Josh about this. So welcome to the show, Josh. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be able to talk more about disability employment and what my organization, the Next Step Programs, is doing.
Yeah. So as you know, audience, we're going to have a lot of contact information for Josh and his program. And so you'll be able to see all that in the show notes. But let's just jump right in, Josh. You know, like most of us, you come to this from a very personal experience. Tell us a little bit about your family and how you got involved.
Sure. So my story starts back off in elementary school, really. I was in a public school, and at the time, inclusive education was becoming more and more common. So there were young adults, or not even young adults, kids at the time with disabilities who were in the classroom. And I became friends with a little girl who had Down syndrome. And at the time, I didn't really understand and what a disability was, but I understood that she was a little bit different and that I was a little bit different, but that we were still friends, and that when I had a bad day, she could make my day, you know, a good day with a smile or with a simple joke. And as time went on, I started to learn that people with disabilities were awesome friends, and that all they needed was somebody to presume competence or to treat them like a peer. And they would rise to the occasion and do things that other teachers and students might not think were possible. So my story began back in elementary school and middle school, but at the time I didn't realize where it was going. I just knew that I cared about people with disabilities and people with disabilities cared about me, and that, you know, we all belonged in the same community. And as I approached high school, I started to think about college and what came after college. And I knew, because I went to a really good public school, that I was going to graduate from high school, go on to college and get a job. You know, it was kind of lined up for me. That was the path. And when I began asking my friends with disabilities what came next, the answers were, I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, I want to get a job, but I'm not sure how to do that. I would love to go to college, but I'm not sure if I can. And it wasn't until I had a conversation with my best friend, Megan, who has Down syndrome, that I realized how unfair the world was set up for people with disabilities. As a student without a disability, I was going to go on to college, get a job, and, you know, live happily ever after. Megan did not have that same easy flow. She had to figure out what came next. You know, she had to figure out how she was going to lead an everyday life without having access to the same services she had throughout her time in public school. And, you know, that frustrated me, beyond frustrated me. You know, I didn't understand why I was being set up for success and Megan was not. So that was in 2015. And I was 16 at the time. And I had just come home from a camp for young adults with Down syndrome, where I was a counselor. And there I met my co-founder, who was a grad student in vocational rehabilitation, which is the study of helping people with disabilities or veterans find jobs, or, you know, obtain or re-obtain employment. So we hit it off right away, because I wanted to build a future where Megan would thrive. And he had a brother who had a disability, who has a disability, who was going through this same exact process. So it was really important for us to understand why this was happening and then say, well, we're going to do something about it. And we were very young, and many would call us naive at the time, but we created the Next Step programs in 2015 while we were both still students, with the mission of creating opportunities for people with disabilities after they leave high school.
Yeah, that's so cool. So before I jump into, you know, what your program does, tell me, how hard was it? Maybe it wasn't hard, but I think it was. How hard was it to build something from scratch like this?
Hard. I mean, it took a lot of time, and a lot of people doubted us along the way. I mean, we were two young men who had these big, bright ideas saying we were going to solve problems that many other people could not solve. So in the beginning, it was really a battle of proving who we were, what we could do, you know, that our passion wasn't just passion, but that there were skills and, you know, a plan in front of us. So it was hard. I mean, you know, we had to develop resources. We had to, you know, get degrees, prove credibility, you know, build trust with families so that they would want to come to our programs and they would want to work with us to solve these solutions. Because, you know, one of the biggest things in the disability field is trust. A lot of organizations and a lot of providers lose the trust of families because they don't carry through or follow through with promises that were made. Right. So it took us, you know, a long time to establish that trust. But, you know, now We are growing, and we're growing quickly because people are seeing the impact of our programs and the, you know, the quality and care that we provide to everybody that we serve. And now it's more of an exciting time. Whereas the first 8 years, you know, I have to say that it was hard, and it was a lot of hard work, and you know, we had to bring a lot of smart people into it, but it was worth it in the long run.
But in truth, you know, whenever you have to contract with the government, work with state agencies and become, you know, a provider of services, as I air quote these things,
yeah,
you know, you get into the same problems and the same issues that everybody else has. And the reason why these types of services fail to really meet the needs of people, right?
Right.
So I'm going to get into, like, why are you different? How Sure. is it that you're meeting the needs of people when, you know, where others have failed, or have maybe not failed, but maybe fallen short?
Sure. Definitely a better way to put it, fallen short, because fallen a lot short. Of times it's not a malicious intent. It's just that mm-hmm. sometimes the system is set up and stacked against you where, you know, it is hard to
right.
achieve success. But I get that question asked a lot. And I think the easiest way to answer that is, for the first 8 years of my organization, we operated outside of the system. We were not a waiver provider. We were building programs that were privately funded through us, or through families, or through grants, or through financial aid funds. My mom passed away in 2021, and when she passed away, we established a fund in her memory that raised around $40,000 that we used to fund our programs. So for the first 8 years, we were able to really build programs that families were asking us for, not with the red tape in mind, not with do this, do that. It was, what are you looking for, and how can we provide that? And that is what led us to grow and develop from one county in Pennsylvania to now five counties in Pennsylvania. But, you know, now we are becoming a waiver provider for a couple of reasons. And, you know, my organization will always continue to be innovative, you know, and I want us to be 10 steps ahead of the curve. However, you know, some families cannot afford to privately pay for services. They must rely on their public funding. And because of how the waiver system works, you have to provide the services that the government has identified in order to access that money. Now, there are a lot of rules and a lot of conditions, but it doesn't mean that you have to change your values or the way that you treat families or the way that you prioritize the needs of the young adults that you're serving. And, you know, the government agencies have done a great job identifying the end goal, like a good vision. It's just, how do you implement it? And I feel that that's yes. where providers are falling. And that's where we're going to pick up and say, well, we're going to take this on, and we're going to do it correctly. And we're going to do it the way you want it to be done, so that, you know, we have the funding and sustainability to do it. But, you know, we're never going to lose sight that the people that matter at the end of the day are the young adults and adults being served, if that makes sense.
Wahoo. We're going to map our way through all of that conversation today over the next 20 minutes. So first and foremost, I'm so sorry for your loss, to lose your mom at such a young age, Josh. I'm so very sorry. And thank you so much for the meaningful way that you are remembering her for all of us in the disability community. What a tribute that you have done. You know,
thank you. You know, it was certainly not an easy time. And, you know, there's two things you can do when things get bad. You can keep moving forward and find something that you're inspired by or passionate about and go after that, or you can crumble. And my mom was the type of person that chose option A, you know, keep moving forward. She was an educator for 30 years. So a lot of what I do is in the principles of education, but just through the lens of disability. So, you know, I appreciate your kind words, and, you know, it's an honor for me to be able to continue doing what I'm doing in her memory, because it gives me the ability to keep, you know, her name alive.
Well, as you know, I do the same in my daughter's name. So I'm right there with you. But I had to stop for a minute and just acknowledge that. That's such a beautiful thing. So let's take a step back and unpack Sure. a lot of what you said. So first and foremost, let's talk about the basics of, you know, vocational rehab, vocational education. What are the basics of that? You know, what does that look like? What does it mean when you have a vocational counselor or vocational assistance?
So there's lots of different options, you know, as folks are getting ready to transition out of high school. And I'm going to reference just in the state of Pennsylvania or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but, you know, there is a state agency called the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, and each state has a form of a VR office. And within the VR office are VR counselors, vocational rehab counselors, and their responsibilities are to help young adults or adults obtain employment, those who have disabilities, or it could be veterans who are trying to re-enter the workforce when they come home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these specialists are trained in teaching people the skills they need to maintain employment. And that can mean, you know, how do you interview? How do you create a resume? How to manage your time, how to advocate for your wants and needs in the workplace, how to, you know, make sure that you're represented, you know, from a legal and advocacy perspective. You know, vocational training is really to help someone become prepared for the workforce and not just help them get the job, but keep that job. But, you know, the reality is that this is a very hard process because it has to be an individualized process, right? Like each person needs different supports, different attention, different accommodations. And, you know, there's always been a shortage of staffing in terms of vocational rehab support, you know, at least as long as I'm aware of, and I'm sure it dates back, you know, past me. But then there's also, you know, another end of this where there's job development and job coaching, which is not the same thing as a vocational expert, but is more specific to people with disabilities. Once they get the job, you know, how do they maintain that job? Well, they have supports that eventually are supposed to fade out. And that comes in the form of a job coach.
Mm-hmm. And it's different timing depending on the person. Some people need it for longer than others.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, when you're going through graduating high school, you're only allotted a certain amount of hours by the state. Now, if you run out of those hours of services, you can file for, you know, an extension or, you know, a renewal for a certain amount of hours, but it's not something that's this guaranteed you get this forever service. You know, it's supposed to help you become employed and then stay employed.
And give us an example of what a job coach might do for you if you get a job. Let's say one of the more common jobs is working at a grocery store.
I was going to use a grocery store, but I have a better example because it's a bakery. Some of our families have actually started a bakery in Buckingham called Bakeability. It's run by families and young adults who have disabilities. It's awesome. You know, the bakers are people with disabilities. The counter associates are people with disabilities. The people running the bakery all have disabilities. However, some of the young adults do need supports. So, you know, in some instances, a job coach would be there in the beginning to help somebody with the exchange of money and cookies, right? You're buying a dozen cookies, it costs $5, you know, or $5.25. Someone hands me a 10. How much change do I have? You know, the system is going to show you how much change is due, but the young adult or adult might need help with counting out that change and distributing it back. You know, a job coach in the bakery setting could be helping with, you know, these are the five ingredients you need to make the cookies. But you know, the eggs are on the top shelf and you're not tall enough to reach it. A job coach can help you by supporting or showing you where the stool is, where you can put the stool down, step up to get the eggs and come down. Really just helping you learn and transition into the work environment. And then as things go, the job coach is supposed to slowly fade out so that the employee can really maintain and, you know, stay there long term, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So now we've got people who are employed and their supports are fading away. Mm-hmm. Are there any other parts of the program that support them? Or are they, you know, just completely, you know, not part of your program anymore?
Well, this, what I was just referencing earlier was how the VR system works in general, not necessarily how my program works. So
Okay.
what we previously just discussed was how the current system works. You know, my program comes in at age 14 and remains in someone's life until they want to transition out of it. What we're doing is we're not doing the traditional supported employment model yet. You know, if we become a waiver provider, that is something we would look into doing in addition. But what makes us different is that we're providing opportunities for people with disabilities to come together to build on specific skills, make friends, and network so that they're building a community so that when one person gets a job, five others can get a job. So what TNS is currently doing is, you know, we run programs Monday through Thursday, in the evening, after school, and after work for those that are in school and those that are at work. We have programs from 5 to 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday that focus on different skill sets that you need to become a successful adult. So we've got advocacy, we've got entrepreneurism, we've got independent living, cooking, meal prepping, consumer math, which where they learn how to use credit cards and checks and debit cards and how to keep a bank balance. We have a class called Cinematic Themes, which is a movie class where we talk about feelings and emotions. It was a college class that I had taken that we adapted for young adults with disabilities. So essentially, there's about 10 unique programs that we're offering that give young adults an opportunity to make friends outside of their school system, to
I
maintain
see.
relationships, and then prepare for after high school. And then in addition to that, we launched a community-based day program in this past summer. And what our day program does is provide young adults with disabilities an opportunity to get out of their houses from 9 to 4, and explore their community. The program's called Explore. And what they do is they explore the different work sites around our community. You know, they do career explorations. They actually go and volunteer at sites. We try different restaurants. We go on hikes. We access our community. So that, you know, the community starts to realize that we are here and that they need to continue to make employment opportunities to meet the growing need of our community. So that's really what my organization does and how it contrasts with what the current system is doing. You know, we're saying that keep doing what the system is trying to do, keep moving it forward, but let's continue to provide more opportunities and let's continue to innovate other solutions. And it might not work for every single family, but it's going to work for some families because if you're listening, you're building things based off of their needs and not what you see the need as.
Right. So I'm hearing that it's an enhancement to the basic needs of what our government systems are offering, and you're offering an enhancement to that.
I'm offering a continuation of it where it doesn't run out. You know, when the 90 hours that the government gives you to develop these skills runs out, or when, you know, there's a lack of providers in an area where services aren't provided, you know, I'm creating an additional opportunity for young adults to learn those soft skills. And, you know, the organization is not just stopping here. Like we're partnering with employers, we're providing trainings and coachings, you know, we're working one-on-one with young adults and families to help build
So,
customized paths.
yeah, I saw that. So you're working almost on some pre-vocational skills, soft skills with folks who aren't quite ready yet, not quite ready for prime time yet. So I love that. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Absolutely. So there's multiple different stages of this. You know, when you think about your own journey or my own journey, it was kind of an expedited journey because you know, there was a path to follow. There's not always a path to follow for people with disabilities. And, you know, oftentimes the special education arena has to focus on certain skills and not focus on other skills. So by the time you get ready to graduate, you know, the young adult might be able to do a couple of things really well, but then they're going to be lacking in another area that is essential for employment or essential for independent living. So we are not just focused on the job aspect of it, we're focused on the journey towards employment because there are a lot of skills essential that need to be transferred in order to maintain that job. So we provide programs that do focus on pre-vocational training. You know, we've got employment classes, we've got career readiness, we've got, you know, a lot of what we do in the Explore program is pre-vocational and vocational training. So you know, it's really important to view it as a process, a journey, and not just a destination. So yes, there's this pre-14 age group that you have to think about. There's this 14 to 18 age group you have to think about, and then there's this 21 plus age group that you have to think about, because those are the folks that are about to lose all their services. But right. In order for them to get to 21 plus and maintain and be successful in that transition, there's a lot that needs to happen in the years before that help prepare the young adult for that success.
Well, let me tell you what I'm super excited about is this whole idea of entrepreneurship, because many, many people with disabilities are finding their jobs through entrepreneurship or through just creating a job themselves, you know, and maybe that doesn't suit. Sometimes you get a lot of, you know, sort of negative feedback or negative talk in the disability community. Oh, who cares about dog walking or baking things or selling art?
And I think the entrepreneurism is the most brilliant path forward. You know, what other job do you have complete control over? Is which when you start your own business. And, you know, as a founder myself, you know, I've worked at other jobs, you know, and I've liked where I've worked before, but there is always something pulling me towards, you know, I want to help build something. I want to help create something. I just don't want to follow a vision. And I tell the young adults I work with all the time, starting your own business can be the most fulfilling thing in the world. Right. So I agree. I mean, pushing people towards self-employment and family-owned businesses, I think that's the disability community saying we're taking control. You know, we're not going to wait for you to build opportunities for us anymore. We're going to build them ourselves. And I think that's just going to push us as a community way forward.
So are you working with foundations and getting grants and, you know, how's that going? Are you finding that you've got a lot of reception to that idea of doing this?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, we have grown immensely in terms of our ability to maintain and build resources over the last 2 years in particular. I think that there is this growing desire to want to create a more inclusive, equitable world. I think we're seeing that in all realms, not just disability, but you're seeing it in race and religions and sexualities and genders and all of that. The world is becoming this more inclusive place. So I think that there is this greater reception towards equity. However, I do feel that it's hard for people outside of the disability community, or not hard. I don't think that these issues are as important for folks who are outside of our community. You know, our families are working hard. Our young adults are working hard. The advocates and organizations that are trying to create change for the disability community are, you know, consistently and constantly advocating and educating. What we need to have happen is people outside of the disability community, they need to start caring. They need to start recognizing that disability truly impacts all of us at one point or another in our life, whether it's a short-term disability or a long-term disability. At some point in our lifetime, whether it's us or someone we love, we're going to experience the lived experience of disability. So, you know, it's really important, I think, for us to continue to educate others so that there is this growing support of the work that we're doing. But, you know, I would say that there are months where we have tremendous success pulling in funds from grants or pulling in funds from, you know, major donors. But then there's other times where there's this uphill battle of we have to first educate you on why you need to care and then educate you on what we do, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I would say that what I'm seeing is it's not like there's so much equity at the bank. You know, they're not lending funds, for example, to, you know, a person with a disability trying to start a business in the same way that they would potentially to you or me.
No, there's a lot of that discrimination still existing. And it's based all on stigma of what we think or thought people with disabilities should or shouldn't do, what they can actually do.
Yeah. So now let's talk about employers. You mentioned working with employers, and I see that's changed a lot in the last decade for sure. Took a little bit of a step back during the pandemic for sure. Now I think advancing forward again, especially with this ability to kind of work from anywhere, which is cool. So talk to me about what your experiences have been like.
So I actually wrote an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer on this last February, not this year, but last February, when there was this huge staffing shortage around the country, not even just the state, but it was this global staffing shortage because people were afraid to go back to work, or, you know, people weren't like getting much more money in unemployment benefits that they were going to wait it out. And, you know, it was that crazy time period. And the headline of my article was, if you can't find employees, why not hire people with disabilities? You know, there were all these job openings that could have been filled by able-bodied young adults with disabilities who have skills or who could be trained on how to do these jobs. But right. I kept seeing, we're hiring, help wanted, this and that. And, you know, on the other side of it, a lot of families that I worked with were also saying they didn't really want their kids working at that time because it was COVID and some of their children were immunocompromised. So, you know, COVID created this really catch-22 situation where there was finally all these jobs open and opportunities, but there was still this public health crisis of, should I be physically at work yet? Mm-hmm. But something that you said that is very interesting that I see as a trend helping us moving forward is we have discovered that most of us can do our jobs from home, and removing that barrier of transportation, of traveling to your house from your house to work, is going to create a lot more options for people with disabilities. Sure. Because transportation tends to be the largest barrier restricting young adults with disabilities from accessing, you know, different employment settings. So, you know, I think that COVID threw a number on a lot of us and definitely mm-hmm. made things more challenging and more complex. But in a lot of ways, I think that it also opened up avenues for new opportunities. And, you know, it showed me that we are heading in a different direction where, you know, whether it's people building their own businesses that are accessible to them or transitioning into this remote model of working, there's now multiple new opportunities and options for people with disabilities to find employment. I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, I hope that's true, because I'm still kind of seeing the same old of, you know, it's the movie theater jobs, it's the grocery store jobs.
Yep.
It's, you know, a lot of the same stuff. And, you know,
so recently I've been seeing a lot of new innovation, and not on a massive scale, but on small scales, like you were saying, where it's family led. In Lansdale, Pennsylvania, there's this awesome candle shop called the Shane and Pepper Company that was started by a 14-year-old who has cerebral palsy and his family. And it's a small business candle shop. It's awesome. Not only do they make and produce their own candles on site, and they have a storefront where they sell the candles, they also host candle making events and parties. And the events and parties are staffed by hosts who have people with disabilities who are now event planning, who are learning how to run the party. And, you know, they're educating people not just on how to make a candle, but through that whole process, they're educating them on disability and inclusion. So that's been something really cool that I've seen recently. I've seen, you know, a couple other models like that out in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. There's a new coffee shop called Nior that just opened up. And that is a same story. You know, a family was tired of waiting around for an opportunity and said, we're going to build it. You know, most people know about Biddy and Bose, which is a national movement. You know, the Wright family that started that organization is awesome. I mean, they've got several young adults in their family or several kids in their family that have disabilities. And their story was very similar. They said, well, we're going to create a movement. We're going to create a business. And that movement is changing the way that people with disabilities are viewing themselves and employment altogether. But you're right. I mean, for far too long, we have been forcing folks into three categories, is what we refer to it as food, filth, and flowers. You know, these three industries that we organize people with disabilities in. And while those are great job opportunities for those that are seeking those job opportunities, and, you know, I would never dismiss how important they are to those who hold jobs like that, we shouldn't be limiting ourselves to just those fields when thinking about employment for people with disabilities, when thinking about employment for, you know, any population of individual.
But what it comes down to, Josh, and this is kind of what I want to close our conversation with, sure, is that we're still not asking people what their dreams are, what their goals are. And we're not using those last few years in school to prepare them for planning their life. And
there's I hope one day that there's no need for me to exist, you know, or no need for this organization to exist. But what you just said is the very reason why my organization does exist. The schools have failed. And I, you know, I work with a lot of the schools, and, I don't want to not say it as it is, but, you know, there's over and over again, the schools have let families down and have let young adults down. And that is the very reason that TNS, I believe, exists, is because we're trying to pick up the pieces and say that it doesn't stop right at 21. It doesn't stop when the school doesn't reach these goals or didn't right. ask you what your goals was. You know, this is a lifetime journey of you working towards those goals. And right. you know, I do agree with you. I mean, the system is failing across the country, you know, where it's underfunded. We pay people not enough money. It's hard to recruit staff in this field. You know, this is a job where you really have to care about and, you know, want to do
sure.
in order to do it successfully. And, you know, that's not happening everywhere. So, you know, I do believe that the system is changing. I do think that things are moving forward, but I think that it's not happening as fast as you would like for it to happen, or as I would like for it to happen. But, you know, I hope that my team,
Josh, I mean, 30 years of the ADA, right?
I know we're so far behind. I mean,
we've been doing IEPs for, you know, 3 decades, like, enough already.
I agree.
And school districts have a lot of guidance. They have a transition planning form, and
but are they trained on how to use those things? I would argue mostly not. They don't train their educators on how to support transition. They have these resources, and there is this legislation that guides what you're supposed to do, but who is actually making sure that that's happening? Who's actually pushing that through?
I don't want to get up on my soapbox. They'd rather spend more time disciplining kids than being creative about educating yeah. them. And I know they have a lot on their plates, but for the amount of money, when you look at towns and cities' budgets for education, the amount of money that they spend for what happens to our kids when they leave the special education world,
it's awful.
It's an utter fail.
I agree. I mean, and that's what I'm saying is there is, and at least in the special education world, there is so much money there that is being misallocated or not used appropriately. And, you know, the bottom line is the law says we're all entitled to an equal education, that each one of us is entitled to a free and appropriate public education. And that means at whatever level and whatever accommodations that we require. But the fact of the matter is the state has not provided that to every single person in the Commonwealth, including people with disabilities.
But on average, what happens is it's just costing us money over a lifetime of this person to support them. When, if you look at the data, the federal data, in every state, mostly somewhere between 90 to 95% of those children on IEPs are of average or above average intelligence, which means that they can work. They can access the curriculum. They can learn.
But even let's take that one step further. An IQ test, which is the test to determine intelligence often for, for how smart someone is all communications based. People with disabilities have communication difficulties. So
true.
You're testing you're testing people in a way that they can't answer you. So
I agree. It's insane. You know, when you're talking about people who, you know, may be deaf or hard of hearing, people who are blind or have limited vision. I mean, you know, we really, but let's even say that 10% of the population cannot access the curriculum, but we still have 90% of the kids that were failing. I mean, even if we give them that, right, we're sending kids out into the world who are on IEPs that we could be teaching that we're not, that we could get out into the world and either send into higher education or prepare for work and prepare for independent living. And we're not.
I know.
You know? So This is our system that we have.
It is. And this is why more people need to start caring and doing. And, you know, and if you're a business owner or you're a manager at an organization, that's why it's not just on me and you to change this.
Right.
It's on everybody else to do this.
And if you don't care because you have a heart, care because it costs so much money.
Right. That's the bottom line, is this is an expensive lifetime worth of support. So, you know, if we prepare people how to be employed and how to make money and how to live independently, we're not paying into those benefits or into that system. And that money then could be reinvested back into the community and into society. But if we don't care about these issues, it's not just, you know, it's not just 1 or 2 years we're going to have to worry about for funding a system. It's a lifetime of services that we will need to ensure that there is adequate funding for, not minimal funding for.
Okay. Yeah. So audience, can you tell that I love Josh Fields and I love the Next Step programs? So I want you to go to his website. I want you to check them out. And if you can, please support them at tnsprograms.org. They're awesome. We'll have all their contact information in our show notes. I could talk about this for so long, as you all know, and we will have lots more programs on employment, on entrepreneurship, and on these really important topics around people with disabilities in our communities, because we have to talk about ableism. We have to talk about these topics of fairness and equity. If we don't, you know, right now we're talking amongst ourselves, but we have to keep talking beyond ourselves and beyond our communities. We have to bring people into these conversations. We have to find our allies, and then our allies have to find allies. And we have to keep spreading the word, right? Right now, as far as we know, it's 1 in 5. And some of the data says it may even be 1 in 4. 1 in 4 of the US population may be impacted by a special healthcare need or a disability. That's a lot of people. All right, Josh, listen, any last words, any tips, anything that you'd like to share before we sign off today?
Just that I have seen people with disabilities do amazing things and reach their dreams, reach their goals. You know, my best friend, Megan, who I talked about earlier, is now our office manager, and she works at TNS, makes a livable wage, and she helps run the company that was inspired by her. You know, so I've seen people with disabilities do things that you might not expect them to be able to do. And, you know, what I encourage everyone to do is to presume competence, you know, to raise the bar and to make sure that, you know, you are being as inclusive as you can be. You can't control everybody else, but you can control yourself, and you can control, you know, how you treat others. And, you know, a simple act of kindness can really go a long way in making an impact. And I'm really thankful for the opportunity to be on the show today and to just talk about, you know, what I love most, which is disability equity.
That's really awesome. So nice to meet you. I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you so much for all that you do, for coming on the show today. And if you have anything that you want to talk to Josh about, all the contact information is in our show notes. Keep up the good fight, Josh. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I just wanted to take a second to say how much I appreciate you taking the time to listen to these podcasts. I'm having a blast doing them, and I hope that you're finding the content to be what you were really hoping. If you are, please take a second to leave a rating and a review. It's so helpful in getting this content out to people who really need to hear it. Thank you so much.